Director General, welcome to Conversation With.
Thank you very much for receiving me.
Ever since September the 11th, all of security has got very, very cumbersome. Are we ever going to see a return to slightly simpler things where we could just sort of walk onto the plane without having to, you know, almost disrobe and show everything in our wallets and our bags?
You know, every one of us would dream of that, but in the short and mid-run, I do not expect any change in our security rules. Probably they will be tightened further.
But why? Isn't technology...
Because the security issue is hovering above our sector, and we don't know yet where and what could be the next threat, but we have to anticipate. And the recent decisions that were made in the US or in the UK for the laptop ban, if you remember, that we have influenced to try to implement reasonable decisions, policies, and measures, you know, show that, you know, the danger still exists. And so we would be totally not responsible if we say to passenger, don't worry, you can embark without any security check. What we can do is to invest in technologies that are first efficient and effective, that can detect, you know, the potential threat, but are also much more, let's say, passenger friendly. You know, our dream is to have a kind of corridor or gate through which you go without getting totally naked, and which would be able, you know, to be totally secure. And we are very close to that.
Yes, what about the suggestion that you'd be able to have, you know, sort of the normal travellers? The facial recognition would mean that most of us would not have to have very high security checks, and that only, so to say, at-risk persons would have these higher security checks, or perhaps persons who don't travel as much. In other words, you differentiate between passengers.
We experience these type of measures. You know, some states are recommending profiling. We are also working on data transfer that would allow the states, you know, to communicate and to have a clearer idea of potential dangerous individuals, and so identify potential threatening people. But for the moment, it will be difficult, you know, to make our discrimination, a selection, without, you know, increasing the level of risk.
What about dangers that come from conflict zones? We've had, for example, just recently in December, a Cathay Pacific cruise said that they thought they saw a North Korean missile whiz by them, and very close to home for us here in Asia, MH17, which was shot down by a missile over the Ukraine.
Yeah.
How are we going to stop that?
First of all, what we have tried to do after the tragedy of the Malaysian flight was to create inside, you know, the international organization with the ICAO, a kind of repository of information collected by various sources, mainly states, to be able to assess the risk on various, you know, non-flying zones or dangerous flying zones. Unfortunately, it has been a failure.
But this is not encouraging to hear, sir.
No. And the reason why, and the reason for that, and we are urging government to change their attitude, is that it's difficult for government to collaborate, to cooperate, to release information about, you know, what they consider as secret sources or very sensitive information. So the collaboration has been a failure. We haven't been able, you know, to set up something efficient, credible. So airlines rely mainly on public information, on some contacts they might have with the various intelligence agencies from their countries or from friendly countries or various sources. But these days, what the system which is in place is not totally positive. We are advocating in favor of that, but for the moment, unsuccessfully.
So there's nothing more you feel that, that IATA can do to bring even more pressure to bear?
Push governments to cooperate and to exchange information and to release, you know, the necessary information. We do not ask for any sensitive, you know, information that could threaten the sources or the individuals that are in the field. I understand that, you know, we have to protect these sources. But we would like to have the result of the information and consequently be able, you know, to implement the appropriate measures.
So basically you're saying that governments are the ones who are actually putting their own citizens and others at risk. But,
you know, basically security is the responsibility of governments. We have our part by proposing and implementing the right measures. Because we transport 10 million people a day, 10 million a day, huh? And a few tons of cargo a day. So we claim not to be our security specialist, but to have some ideas to secure passengers and cargo. So by working together with governments, but relying on, you know, government sources and government means and government legal responsibilities and political responsibilities, we could build something more secure. But the political will has to be there.
And it isn't there at the moment, is what you're
really
saying. What about another sensitive issue, and that is basically political decisions that also impact airlines and air travel? Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the ones that that President Trump initially tried to implement with blocking certain kinds of countries, the citizens of certain kinds of countries from coming into America. It was delayed, but it looks as if it might actually be implemented. How does IATA deal with these sort of politically motivated changes?
No, we say two things. First of all, it is the responsibility of each state to open or to close its borders. That's the rule of the international world, the international society. But we strongly advocate in favor of opening borders. You know, for the industry, it's obvious that opening borders is a plus. Because you exchange people, you exchange ideas, people can meet, you exchange cultures, you trade goods. So it's viewed from the industry, any restrictive measures on borders is a bad news. So we are advocating in favor of the opposite. But we understand that sometimes, and for reason that we can understand, security being one of them, by the way, a government can close partially its borders to some other areas of the world or to some people. That's possible, but it's very rarely good news.
It may be couched as being security, but sometimes we can see that there are also other motivations as well. For example, in the case of Qatar and the blockade of Qatar, how did IATA deal with that?
But what we said when the decision was made by the three or four countries, you know, neighboring or close to Qatar, we said the essential part for us is to maintain connectivity between Qatar and the rest of the world. So what we have done is we have worked closely with ICAO, Qatari authorities, and airlines to see how we were able to design new routes to save Qatar from every part of the world, and respecting, you know, the blocking decisions that had been made by the neighboring countries. So now there are routes that are slightly longer than before that allow airlines which want to fly into Qatar to fly normally with the adequate, you know, routes and.
Did you get any complaints from the countries that were blockading Qatar about this, where you're basically helping Qatar to bypass, so to say?
Not bypass, no. So, to stay connected, and then the file has been put in front of the ICAO, which is the right political. It's a UN agency, as you know. It's the right political body to deal with these problems, and so then the states can express themselves. Qatar can advocate in favor of his position, but the others as well. And then the decision is made inside ICAO to try to find a solution and to solve the problem.
What do you see as IATA's mandate in these tricky situations?
Our mandate is to be sure that the Chicago Convention, which is, you know, the legal umbrella under which aviation is working and ICAO is working, and that guarantee or as built the basis for the freedom for aviation and for aircraft to fly, and the right and obligation that states have toward each other. We try to ensure that this convention is properly applied in conjunction with ICAO. And for us, one of the key elements is to ensure that connectivity is applied, and that we can develop, you know, flights. That's the interest of the aviation. We say, you know, that aviation is a business of freedom. It's not by chance. It's not only a motto. We strongly believe in that. You know,
freedom. Isn't that a political statement almost, sir?
No, I think
the business of freedom sounds magnificent, but it has these political overtones as well.
It's probably something which is ethical, moral.
Yes, but even more complicated.
But we are proud of that. And we are proud of that because we think that we participate into giving to this planet some more happiness, perhaps.
Yeah? So everybody has a right
some
to
more,
be
some
free.
Some more prosperity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
You've and freedom to move.
When there is a coup somewhere, you have two big targets, the radio and the TV. So yourself and the airport, which is closed. It means because you want to close the links and to restrict freedom. So it's not by chance that we say that we are the business of freedom.
Tremendous amounts of infrastructure need to be built. And you've been actually a little bit critical in saying that here in Asia, there are several cities and several airports that really need to beef up.
I will tell you, I am critical for almost any part of the world these days. Because there is very fantastic opportunity for us. We have growth. We know the number of passengers will double in the coming 15 to 20 years. So that's a fantastic opportunity. It's a big challenge, because if you want to fly these passengers properly, you know, so comfortably, efficiently, safely, the infrastructure must follow if you want to cope with that growth. And currently, we have an infrastructure crisis which is happening almost everywhere in the world. Whether it is air traffic control, so managing the sky, are we able to manage safely the sky with twice more aircraft? And on the airports, do we have the capacity, you know, to welcome or to park all these aircraft?
You call it a crisis.
Yeah,
doesn't that sound very dramatic?
No, it's a crisis because you know we know that currently we have our air traffic control shortage. We have airport capacity limitations everywhere in the world, in Asia as well. And decisions have to be made now because it's long-term programs. So if you made a decision, you know, to buy a new air traffic control system or to extend an airport today, it will be implemented in between 5 to 10 years. So we say, come on, governments, do the job. It's absolutely key. Otherwise, you know, aviation will be capped. And so you will lose our GDP, jobs, trade.
You do a lot of nagging, don't you?
I push. You know, it's my job to push, and it's the airlines, they desperately ask for that.
But these infrastructure projects are not cheap, and who is going to pay for them? Some countries are opting for passengers have to contribute as well.
There is something different in the aviation compared to the other transportation means. We pay for infrastructure. We pay for airports, we pay for air traffic control, we pay for overflight fees. So we pay. You do not pay for all the roads you use when you drive your car. You have toll roads, but you have a lot of roads that are for free. So we pay for that, first thing. And we consider it's a normal way of financing infrastructure. What we are very worried about is, first, the cost of infrastructure is skyrocketing everywhere. You know, we see the projects, you know, having, you know, double digit and billions of Singapore dollars, US dollars, pounds, or euros, you know, and we are not totally convinced that everything is justified. So the costs are skyrocketing. And secondly, some governments are asking us to pre-finance, so to pay in advance. And we are against that. Now, you know, what would you say if you were asked to pay for a bridge just close to your home, or toll bridge just 3 years in advance before it is built? You will be a bit reluctant, probably.
Yes, but the argument being that you're going to be the one using it, and you will be the one also making a profit from it when it's built.
The user will not make any profit from that. So the owner probably. And what we think is that, you know, investment has to be made either by the private or the public sector. For the airports, we are in favor of governments keeping the airports in their hands, or local authorities, public authorities, keeping the airports in their hands. They can bring private money, but they should not totally give up ownership.
That's very curious. You're in favor of it being public. You don't want to have privatized airports.
We are a bit reluctant because the experience we have everywhere in the world has been negative.
Your airlines are private. Your membership are private. Some of them are national carriers, of course, many are.
What we say is privatization of airports, almost everywhere in the world, I have no exception, has been a failure in terms of cost and charges and quality of service for airlines. All our members are complaining about the privatization of their airports, saying that, you know, they pay more for a quality which is not totally obvious, to be polite. So the regulation for these private local monopolies is very difficult, because balancing, you know, the public and private interests, you know, the passenger, airline and airport and shareholders of the of these equipments, you know, interest is really a tricky issue that has not been solved properly anywhere. Huh? When I mean anywhere, it's that we haven't found a good solution in any country.
Well, to give
and so what we say to government, if you want to go to privatization, you should respect certain do's and don'ts, and if you can avoid it. But you can bring private money, for instance, by awarding a management contract, a concession. There are other means than purely privatization. Do you know that in one of the probably most capitalist country in the United States, the airports are non-for-profit by law? And I had a memory that my American partners, when I was running an airline, they were furious about the way Europe was privatizing the airport. They couldn't understand that. Saying, in the US, it's non-for-profit. What are you doing with local monopolies? So, you know, it's a difficult issue. Huh?
Normally, we would say that why not let free market forces also take their play with airports? Why are airports so special?
Because they are local monopolies. So even from a theoretical point of view, when you teach economy, when you learn economy, you know, privatizing monopolies is, from a market standpoint, is a very controversial issue. And the controversial issue is in regulation, because if we say yes, we privatize, then you have to find the appropriate regulatory system to manage that. And we haven't found it. So we are working with government, by the way, and with civil aviation, with economists, with a lot of people to be able to propose a regulatory framework and regulatory bodies that would be able to cope with that difficulty properly. But we haven't found the magic solution up to now.